Well, that Congressional Budget Office report that David mentioned has provided new ammunition for protesters whose signs declare, "We are the 99%. The study found that the richest 1% of Americans more than doubled their share of national income in the last 30 years. And the vast majority of the population is getting a smaller slice of the economic pie. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now with more. And Scott, when it comes to income inequality, how unequal are we?
Well, Melissa, we are getting more unequal. More and more of the income's being concentrated in the top tier. If you go back to 1979, which was the starting point for that CBO study, at that point, the top 20%, the richest 20% of households, were collecting about 43% of all the income in the country. Now, that's over half. And a lot of that increase was the very tippy top, the 1% at the top of the income distribution. As their share of national income has soared, the share for everyone else, the other 80%, has gone down.
And Scott, did the Congressional Budget Office explain what's behind this tilt toward the wealthiest Americans?
Well, they did. They said that a lot of the increase in inequality can be chalked up to just structural changes in the economy. And economists have offered a lot of theories for why there's bigger and bigger returns to the top earners now. There's the winner-take-all phenomenon, where superstar performers in various fields get a bigger reward while average performers get less. There is the decline of unions, which used to give ordinary workers more bargaining power. Globalization keeps wages in check for a lot of people. And at the same time, we've seen pay for top executives soar. So there's a lot of it that's sort of economic background factors. But at the same time, we also are seeing government policy play a role. The government is now less aggressive than it used to be in taxing the rich and giving money to the poor with various aid programs. And so that has added to the inequality.
How does this report, do you think, inform the debate here in Washington and beyond on the campaign trail?
Well, President Obama and Senate Democrats have called for higher taxes on the top earners. President Obama also often phrases this as, the people who've done very well in this economy can afford to give more. And the CBO study does give some weight to that argument, that they certainly have the means to pay higher taxes. We saw a study by the New York Times and CBS that found 2 out of 3 Americans support higher taxes on millionaires. At the same time, Americans are often skittish about redistributionist tax policies. Remember when President Obama told Joe the Plumber he wanted to spread the wealth around and the buzzsaw of criticism that followed?
Yeah, and Republican presidential hopefuls are picking this up as well in their message on the campaign trail.
That's right, and they're, of course, pushing in the opposite direction. We've seen a variety of flat tax proposals and flat-er tax proposals coming from the GOP. Those would have the effect of accelerating this trend towards inequality. Several of the GOP candidates have also floated the idea of reducing or eliminating taxes on capital gains and dividends. Now, one of the things that the CBO found is that earnings on investments plays a smaller part in the top earners' bank accounts than it used to, but it is still a significant part of what the top earners make. And so if you did away with taxes on dividends and capital gains, that would amount to a windfall for those who are already disproportionately well off.
Okay, NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. Netflix, the once vaunted DVD rental and streaming service, is imploding on Wall Street. Since July, the company's stock has lost more than two-thirds of its value, much of that just this week. NPR's Wendy Kaufman explores what went wrong.
By now, you've probably heard the numbers. Netflix lost 800,000 U.S. subscribers in the past 3 months. It was a stunning reversal for a company that appeared to be doing so well for so long. Over the summer, Netflix raised prices. The package of DVDs by mail and online streaming soared from $10 to $16. Customers were furious and canceled their subscriptions. Analyst Dan Rayburn is with the consulting and research firm Frost & Sullivan.
I think that they maybe took for granted the fact that people love Netflix so much and were so loyal to the brand that they could do anything they want.
Then in September, the company made matters worse. Rayburn explains Netflix announced it would split its business in two. Its streaming service would continue to be called Netflix, but a separate company would handle the DVDs.
You know, Netflix has always come to the market with something that's easy, simple. It's very smart. It's why the service has done well. So for them to even consider and to think that they're going to roll out two separate services with two separate websites, with two separate queues, that's not simple.
The backlash to the plan was so intense, Netflix was forced to abandon it. Rich Greenfield, an analyst at BTIG, says the company was looking at data showing that new subscribers were overwhelmingly signing up for streaming only, and the use of DVDs by existing customers was falling. That, he says, led Netflix to believe customers didn't value the DVDs all that much. But it turns out that even customers who don't use DVDs seem to like having access to them.
I think they misread the data in some ways, and that led them to try to accelerate the shift from DVDs to streaming faster than they otherwise should have.
Netflix co-founder and CEO Reed Hastings probably wouldn't dispute that. The man who graced a cover of Fortune magazine last year now concedes Netflix was overconfident and moved too quickly. For Netflix, getting back on track may not be easy. Customer goodwill can be hard to recapture, and the company's missteps may have given Amazon.com, which recently launched its own streaming service, a golden opportunity to gain customers at its expense. Wendy Kaufman, NPR News.
It's time for another home video recommendation from our movie critic, Bob Mondello. This week, ahead of Halloween, he suggests a new set of classic films guaranteed to send a shiver up your spine. It's Alfred Hitchcock, The Essentials Collection.
You want to be scared shoutless? These are the films to do it. Psycho. Rear Window.
I wonder if it's ethical to watch a man with binoculars and a long focus lens.
The Birds. North by Northwest, and Vertigo. Five by the Master in one remastered package. By their last release in theaters, some of these films were in pretty bad shape. Happily, Universal's frame-by-frame restoration didn't just clean them up. It yielded some nifty bonuses, especially for fans of composer Bernard Herrmann. Ever wondered what Psycho's shower scene would have sounded like without his screeching violins amping up the horror? Janet Leigh's no slouch. But that's just not the same. And on North by Northwest, you can play the whole movie with just the music track, though that means you won't hear Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint chattering away as they cling by their fingernails from Mount Rushmore.
What happened to the first two marriages?
My wives divorced me.
Why?
Oh, I think they said I led too dull a life. Come on.
Other extras include a truly terrible ending. The director was forced to shoot for Vertigo's overseas engagements at the insistence of foreign censors. Also, Peter Bogdanovich doing a terrific Hitchcock impression, Tippi Hedren's screen test for The Birds, and Hitchcock himself regaling the press with how The Birds got such a short title.
Just two words. There were three, but we cut the first word four. And call it simply The Birds.
Alfred Hitchcock, The Essentials. Five classics from a filmmaker who knew how to amuse while scaring the yell out of you. I'm Bob Mondello.
Today, President Obama announced a plan to help college graduates who are struggling to pay back their federal student loans. He proposed a more aggressive version of a plan that bases borrowers' monthly payments on their income. That's something he pushed through Congress in 2009. But as NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports, many graduates say even the new plan doesn't go far enough.
Under President Obama's plan, students' monthly payments on their government-backed loans would be capped at 10% of their discretionary income.
Because of this change, about 1.6 million Americans could see their payments go down by hundreds of dollars a month. And that includes some of the students who are here today.
And if 20 years down the road you still haven't finished paying back the money you borrowed, the federal government will forgive the balance. Also beginning next January, students and college graduates will be able to consolidate their loans at much lower interest rates. Students at the University of Colorado at Denver cheered, of course, but Anthony de la Rosa, 22, is less than thrilled. He graduated last May from the University of Colorado with a degree in international affairs and political science. In a few days, he has to start paying back over $50,000 he borrowed for school.
So my monthly payments are going to be $400 or $500.
That's $400 to $500 a month, which is not going to come down very much, says De La Rosa, because like so many recent graduates these days, over half of the $50,000 he borrowed is in private loans, not subsidized by the government. President Obama's pay-as-you-earn plan does not cover private loans, only federal government loans. And that, says De La Rosa, still leaves him in a bind.
The wiggle room isn't much for students, and there are a lot of students who are, in my case, that have the combination of both private and federal loans, and those students are struggling to get by even if they have a job. And if they don't, those payments are pretty high, and the interest rates on those private loans are ridiculous.
Administration officials concede the plan won't solve every student's debt problem, but it's a start. And they say it won't cost the federal government a dime because it's no longer paying banks billions of dollars in subsidies to issue college loans.
We're very encouraged by the president's proposal, but certainly this initiative alone won't solve the challenges that we have in terms of increasing affordability for higher education.
Jamie Marisotis of the Lumina Foundation says over 30 million Americans still haven't finished paying back their student loans. In fact, student loan debt is now greater than credit card debt. With college tuition and fees climbing faster than inflation, faster than wages and family income, students' and parents' reliance on loans is growing, too. Already, about three-fourths of all the aid students get from the federal government is in loans. And that's a problem, says Marisotis.
So the cap on payments and the efforts to provide a discount on consolidated loans are all steps in the right direction. But over time, the more students borrow, the costlier it's going to be for the federal government and for us as a society.
In Denver, the president said he'll do whatever it takes to help more Americans attend college.
Because no matter how tough times are, no matter how many obstacles stand in our way, we are going to make the dream that all Americans share real once again. And that starts right now. It starts with you.
Still, experts argue, without fundamental changes in the pricing of college education and a more affordable source of government aid to pay for it, more Americans will be priced out of a college education. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
There's more coming up here on All Things Considered.
Science costs money, a lot of it. Money for equipment, for chemicals, for computers. A lab in the U.S. can easily spend millions of dollars each year on supplies alone. These costs are often prohibitive for scientists in the developing world, and that's where a clever idea has made all the difference. Reporter Ari Daniel Shapiro has that story.
It's a Saturday afternoon in Boston, and it's pouring outside. But inside the Harvard Medical School, a corridor is surging with activity. Two small rooms are stacked to the ceiling with boxes of science equipment, and a handful of graduate students are emptying them into the hallway to take an inventory.
Microcentrifuge tubes, radiation counters.
Some micropipetters, which will be super useful.
17 2-liter Erlenmeyer flasks, I think for cell culture.
This looks like a salad spinner.
This is all stuff the Harvard labs no longer need. In many academic and industrial labs around the country, it gets tossed or used for scrap. But here, it has a different fate. Amanda Nutke, who's just defended her PhD, puts down a handful of pipettes and explains.
We help consolidate surplus into shipments to go to labs in developing countries. Our upcoming shipment is going to be going to University of Nairobi in Kenya.
Labs all over the developing world can really use this stuff. Science overseas often stalls due to a lack of basic equipment, and many times teaching labs just don't have enough materials to go around. That's where a nonprofit called Seeding Labs comes in. They shuttle surplus lab supplies from the U.S. to the people who need them in the developing world with the help of student groups like this one. Seeding Labs was founded by Nina Dudnick, who has a Ph.D. from Harvard in molecular biology. I met her on the 14th floor of a building on Boston's waterfront, a temporary space for innovative startups. Dudnick's in her early 30s. She's got short brown hair, and she smiles a lot.
There are talented people everywhere in the world, but they don't have equal access to the resources to do great science.
Dudnick ran into this problem firsthand after she graduated from college. She went to a lab in the Ivory Coast in Africa, where she worked on breeding better varieties of rice. The lab was short on supplies, and her lab mate had to spend a lot of time working around the problem.
A large part of her job was washing and drying disposable plastic test tubes. The goal was to reuse them for 3 months at a time. This is such a commonplace item here that if you drop one on the floor, you throw it away. We would never have ever have thrown them away in the Ivory Coast.
Dudnick spent a year living and working in Africa, and every day she experienced the passion and generosity of those around her.
I loved it there. I had phenomenal friends and neighbors. I was adopted by a village.
So when it was time for her to leave to start her PhD, she knew she couldn't just walk away. She had to do something.
I was coming back to the United States, but at such a remove from the problems on the ground. It gave me something incredibly painful and powerful to think about.
Back at Harvard, she soon found a group of students who felt very much the same. And then one of them spotted science equipment piling up outside the department's repair shop. Labs were simply not coming back to reclaim their old stuff.
He really put two and two together and knew that this equipment could have another home someplace else.
This idea became the heart of Seeding Labs, which Dudnick created in 2008 after she finished her PhD. Today, she's CEO of the group, and she works with two others.
Which is 200-fold increase over a year and a half ago. So for a long time, it was just me.
A world map is tacked up to one of the cubicle walls. It's freckled with pushpins.
These are all of the countries that we've sent lab equipment to. So 16 countries so far, about 23 different institutions.
Seeding Labs ships a 20-foot container full of equipment to the developing world, mostly in Africa, four times a year. In fact, they've got one headed to Kenya this month. They're equipping entire departments of research labs, and they're benefiting thousands of students overseas by stocking teaching labs, too. Someone who's seen how students can benefit is Iboko Duro, a science professor at the Kwame Nkrumah University of Science and Technology in Ghana.
In university, we are training the heart, the mind, and the hand. And so these three key areas must be touched. We can train their minds, we are training their heart, but we must also train their hands. And I think the equipment can do that.
Oduro spent the summer in Boston as part of a new program set up by Seeding Labs. More than just sending equipment out to the developing world, Dudnick started bringing scientists over to the U.S. Iboko Duro and eight other Seeding Labs fellows spent their summer at state-of-the-art facilities across Boston, like here at the Novartis Pharmaceutical Labs in Cambridge. Nina Dudnick believes even though the equipment's absolutely essential, sharing ideas is what science is really about.
How you ask the question is so much more important than how fancy the tool is that you have to answer it.
Ellis Owusu-Dabo runs a tuberculosis lab in Ghana at the Kumasi Center for Collaborative Research. When you go back to Ghana next week, what's on your agenda?
Oh, Ari, you have no idea. It is to continue, and not wane until we see what we want to see, which is good science with good outcomes that we can all be proud of.
Which is exactly what Seeding Labs is aiming for. Whether it's helping science tackle problems like disease and hunger, or helping researchers in the developing world become part of the global scientific community. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel Shapiro.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.